This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Lexus and the Olive Tree by Thomas L. Friedman. Narrated by George Wilson.
Part 3. The Backlash Against the System. Chapter 15. The Backlash. From the movie Jerry Maguire. Ray Boyd. What's wrong, Mommy? Dorothy Boyd. First class, that's what's wrong. It used to be a better meal. Now it's a better life. The annual Davos World Economic Forum is as good a barometer of global affairs as you can find. Every February, the world's great globalizers gather together in the Swiss mountain retreat to celebrate and debate globalization. The meeting is attended by top industrialists, political figures, economists, technologists, scientists, and social scientists from every corner of the world. Each year, one or two individuals stand out as the trendsetters. One year, it was China's economic czar, Zhu Rongji. One year, it was Yasser Arafat, Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres. Another year, it was the Russian reformers. Another year, the battered Asian economic leaders. In 1995, the star of the Davos World Economic Forum was George Soros, the billionaire financier. I know because I was invited to attend a press conference at which representatives of all the world's major media organizations gathered around a conference table and interviewed Soros as if he were the president of a superpower. And he seemed to think he was. Reporters from Reuters, Bloomberg, AP Dow Jones, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Times of London, and The Financial Times grilled Soros on his views about Mexico, Russia, Japan, and global economic trends, and then ran out of the room to file his remarks by telephone. His opinions were carried on the front pages of the International Herald Tribune and many other newspapers the next day. Watching this scene, I felt that I was witnessing an important transition. Soros personified the electronic herd. He was a lead bull, maybe the lead bull. And this was just around the time when many people were beginning to realize that this electronic herd was replacing the Soviet Union as the other superpower in our two-superpower world. Only a few years earlier, Soros had administered a stunning economics lesson to British Prime Minister John Major. Major thought the British pound was properly valued. Soros did not. And in September 1992, Soros led the herd in a campaign to force the British pound down to its right level. Major scoffed at Soros, then sneered at him, then resisted him, then raised a white flag and devalued the pound by 12%. Soros walked away with a profit of $1 billion from a couple of months' work. Goodbye, Soviet Union. Hello, electronic herd. Interestingly enough, a year after first seeing Soros hold court with his own news conference in Davos, I went back to Davos, eager to see who would be the star in 1996. I was standing at a computer terminal in the main hall, retrieving my email messages, when I noticed George Soros walk by. But what struck me was that this year no one was paying any attention to him at all. In fact, he seemed to be all alone. What a difference a year makes. I don't think he could have hired a news conference that year. Why? Who was the star of Davos 1996? None other than Gennady A. Zhuganov, the head of the Russian Communist Party. The Davos Forum is the ultimate capitalist convention. How could this dinosaur from the Jurassic era of the Cold War, Gennady Zhuganov, have been the man of the hour? Because the business and political elites gathered in Davos that year were understanding, many for the first time, that this powerful phenomenon called globalization was also producing an equally powerful backlash in some circles. at that time, it looked like Zhuganov was actually going to defeat Boris Yeltsin for the Russian presidency, and therefore the backlash forces were actually going to take power in a major country. So all the executives at Davos wanted to talk to Zhuganov, the beast of the backlash, and find out what he was going to do with private property, the Russian budget, and ruble-dollar convertibility. I interviewed Zhuganov at the time, and it was clear to me that he didn't have a clue what he was going to do. He seemed to be spending most of his time hiding from the Western business elites. Like other ideological backlashers against globalization, Zhuganov had more attitude than workable programs, more ideas about how to distribute income than about how to generate it. Since then, though, the backlash against globalization has become more apparent and widespread. Let there be no doubt, globalization has fostered a flowering of both wealth and technological innovation, the likes of which the world has never before seen. But this sort of rapid change, as the previous chapters indicate, has challenged traditional business practices, social structures, cultural mores, and environments, and as a result, has generated a substantial backlash, with one of its loudest and most visible manifestations coming at the World Trade Organization summit in Seattle in late 1999. This is not surprising. Markets generate both capital and chaos. The more powerful markets become as a result of globalization, the more widespread and diverse their disruptions. Beyond this general sense of disruption and dislocation, the opponents of globalization resent it because they feel that as their countries have plugged into the globalization system, they have been forced into a golden straitjacket that is one size fits all. Some don't like the straitjacket because they feel economically pinched by it. Some worry that they don't have the knowledge, skills, or resources to enlarge the straitjacket and ever really get the gold out of it. Some don't like it because they resent the widening income gaps that the straitjacket produces, or the way it squeezes jobs from higher-wage countries to lower-wage ones. Some don't like it because it opens them to all sorts of global cultural forces and influences that leave their kids feeling alienated from their own traditional olive trees. Some don't like it because it seems to put a higher priority on laws to promote free trade than it does on laws to protect turtles and dolphins, water and trees. And some don't like it because they feel they have no say in its design. And some don't like it because they feel that getting their countries up to the standards of Das Kapital 6.0 is just too hard. In other words, the backlash against globalization is a broad phenomenon that is fed by many different specific emotions and anxieties. This backlash expresses itself in different forms, through different characters in different countries. This chapter is about those different emotions, forms, and characters, and how they have come together to create a whirlwind that for the moment is only buffeting the globalization system, but one day might become strong enough to destabilize it if we don't take serious backlashers seriously. As I mentioned earlier, in the summer of 1998, I took a tour of Brazil with Conservation International, which had built an eco-park in the Atlantic rainforest, in cooperation with people from the nearby town of Una, in an effort to help them create a tourist industry that might be able to spawn enough jobs for them to quit logging. Conservation International invited Dejair Birchner, the 48-year-old mayor of Una, to show me around and to explain how all this was affecting his town. The mayor was a Paul Bunyan type, whose father and grandfather had been loggers, but now the environmentalists had basically put him out of business. As we walked through the rainforest, Mayor Birchner patted every other tree. He knew each tree species in the rainforest by its Brazilian name. I took an immediate liking to this Brazilian lumberjack. There was something very solid about him. After our walk, we sat on a picnic table on the edge of the Atlantic rainforest and talked about the challenges facing the mayor. The mayor explained to me that intellectually he understood that logging was not sustainable anymore. But as much as he knew this, he also knew that his little town was not prepared for life without logging. We talked for about 30 minutes, and when I was done interviewing the mayor, I thanked him and started to pack up my IBM ThinkPad laptop, when he said to me, "Now, I want to ask you something." "Please," I answered. "Ask anything you like." The mayor then looked me in the eye and said, "Do we have any future?" His question hit me like a fist in the stomach. It almost brought tears to my eyes, looking across the table at this proud, sturdy man, a mayor, no less, asking me if he and his villagers had any future. I knew exactly what he was asking in his question. "My villagers can't live off the forest anymore, and we're not equipped to live off computers. My father and grandfather made a living off logs, and my grandchildren might make a living off the internet. But what are all the rest of us in between supposed to do?" I cobbled together an answer, trying to explain in simple terms that he and his people did have a future, but they needed to start making a transition from an agro-economy to a more knowledge-based economy, beginning by better educating the town's children. The mayor listened, nodded his head, thanked me very politely, and then got up to go to his car. As he was leaving, I pulled the interpreter aside and asked him if he could ask the mayor, when they got to the mayor's car, what he thought of my answer. A few minutes later, the interpreter returned. He reported back that the mayor just wanted to remind me of something he had alluded to in our interview. When he gets to the office every morning, he has 200 people waiting for him, asking for jobs, housing, and food, not to mention out-of-work loggers threatening his life. If he can't provide them with jobs, housing, and food, they will eat the rainforest, whether that's sustainable or not. "He just wanted you to understand that," the interpreter said. Mayor Bierschner represents a whole generation of people around the world today who feel threatened by globalization because they fear that they just don't have the skill sets or the energy to make it into the fast world. I call them the turtles. Why? Because high-tech entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley always like to compare their super competitive business to the story about the lion and the gazelle in the jungle. Every night, the lion goes to sleep in the jungle knowing that in the morning when the sun comes up, if it can't outrun the slowest gazelle, it will go hungry. Every night the gazelle goes to sleep in the jungle, knowing that in the morning, when the sun comes up, if it can't outrun the fastest lion, it's going to be somebody's breakfast. But the one thing that the lion and the gazelle both know when they go to sleep is that in the morning, when the sun comes up, they had better start running. And so it is with globalization. Unfortunately, not everyone is equipped to run fast. There are a lot of turtles out there, desperately trying to avoid becoming roadkill. The turtles are all those who get sucked into the fast world when the walls come down, and for one reason or another now feel economically threatened or spurned by it. It is not because they all don't have jobs. It is because the jobs they have are being rapidly transformed, downsized, streamlined, or made obsolete by globalization. And because this global competition is also forcing their governments to downsize and streamline at the same time, it means many of these turtles have no safety net to fall into. In the Broadway musical Ragtime, there is a scene in which Henry Ford explains the genius of his assembly line. I always remember the verses because they capture so well the world that was once safe for turtles, but is no more. The Broadway version of Henry Ford sings, "See my people? Well, here's my theory of what this country is moving toward. Every worker a cog in motion. Well, that's the notion of Henry Ford. One man tightens and one man ratchets and one man reaches to pull one cord. Cars keep moving in one direction, a genuflection to Henry Ford. Speed up the belt, Sam. mass production will sweep the nation. A simple notion, the world's reward. Even people who ain't too clever can learn to tighten a nut forever, attach one pedal, or pull one lever. Today, alas, people who ain't too clever can't learn to make microchips forever. Good jobs require many skills. I once did a story about how the U.S. Agency for International Development, AID, which usually works to provide job training and economic assistance to developing countries in Africa, was trying to use some of its techniques to help revitalize the inner-city slums of Baltimore. Or as the headline in the Baltimore Sun put it, Baltimore to try third world remedies. One reason Baltimore had summoned AID was that its own turtles simply couldn't make it in the fast world. One city official explained the problem succinctly. In the 1960s, she said, the biggest employer in Baltimore was Bethlehem Steel Corporation. You could get a job at the steel plant with a high school education or less, make a decent living, buy a house, raise your kids, and send them to college. It meant the American dream was open to turtles from even the most disadvantaged neighborhoods. Today, the biggest employer in Baltimore is Johns Hopkins Medical Center. Unless you want to be a janitor, you can't even get a job interview at Johns Hopkins without a college degree. Turtles need not apply. And you certainly can't get a job there if you are one of the 150,000 Baltimore residents out of 730,000 who are functionally illiterate. Baltimore officials kept wondering why the urban poor were not taking fuller advantage of the well-funded social programs in the city when they discovered that most of them couldn't read the signs. This was one reason they summoned AID. It had developed a whole series of cartoon characters and other visual devices to bypass illiteracy in Africa. You want to know what the real irony is? Dr. Peter Bilenson, Baltimore's Commissioner of Health, said to me when I came to interview him. The company that develops these communications programs for AID is from Baltimore. Its office is about 3 blocks from here. As globalization progresses, replacing many manual, repetitive jobs with machines and requiring more skills to do the jobs that are left, the number of good jobs available to turtles becomes fewer and fewer. A Washington Post story from June 1998 about the General Motors strike in Flint, Michigan, told the reader everything about the plight of turtles today. It read, in the past 20 years, GM has cut employment in Flint to 35,000 workers from 76,000, and it says 11,000 more jobs could be eliminated over the next few years. Among its total U.S. workforce, GM has trimmed 297,000 hourly jobs over the past 20 years, cutting the overall number of jobs to 223,000. Some of the jobs were moved to Canada and Mexico, where plants were either more efficient or less costly. But the bulk of the people were simply replaced by machines. The same article quoted George Peterson, president of Auto Pacific Incorporated, a California-based auto industry research and consulting firm, who said that in non-UAW plants in the United States, such as the Marysville, Ohio factory of Honda Motor Company's U.S. subsidiary, workers have multiple skills and are capable of performing multiple tasks. This kind of versatility, he said, helps Honda cut production costs. It's still possible to have a full-time job in this industry if you are willing to do more than one job, Peterson said, referring to the UAW's concerns over job security. So, not only do you need more skills than ever if you want to get a job in manufacturing today, but you need multiple skills to keep your job from going to a robot. This makes it very hard on the turtles. Analysts have been wondering for a while now whether the turtles who are left behind by globalization, or most brutalized or offended by it, will develop an alternative ideology to liberal free market capitalism. As noted earlier, in the first era of globalization, when the world first experienced the creative destruction of global capitalism, the backlash eventually produced a whole new set of ideologies, communism, socialism, fascism, that promised to take the sting out of capitalism, particularly for the average working person. Now that these ideologies have been discredited, I doubt we will see a new coherent universal ideological reaction to globalization, because I don't believe there is an ideology or program that can remove all of the brutality and destructiveness of capitalism and still produce steadily rising standards of living. Another reason the backlash against globalization is unlikely to develop a coherent alternative ideology is because the backlash itself involves so many disparate groups, as evidenced by the coalition of protectionist labor unions, environmentalists, anti-sweatshop protesters, Save the Turtles activists, Save the Dolphins activists, anti-genetically altered food activists, and even a group called Alien Hand Signals, who came together in December 1999 to protest globalization at the Seattle WTO summit. These disparate groups are bound by a common sense that a world so dominated by global corporations and their concerns can't help but be a profoundly unfair world, and one that is as hostile to the real interests of human beings as it is to turtles. But when it comes to actually identifying what the real interests of human beings are and how they should be protected, these groups are as different as their customs. The auto workers, steel workers, and longshoremen who were in Seattle to demand more protectionism doubtlessly couldn't care much whether America allows imports of tuna caught in nets that also snare turtles. Indeed, I wouldn't want to be the turtle that gets in the way of one of those longshoremen offloading a boat in Seattle Harbor. This makes the power of the backlash hard to predict, because while all the groups can agree that globalization is hurtful to them, they have no shared agenda, ideology, or strategy for making it less so for all. That's why I suspect that the human turtles, and many of those who simply hate the changes that globalization visits on cultures, environment, or communities, are not going to bother with an alternative ideology. Their backlash will take a variety of different spasmodic forms. The steel workers will lobby Washington to put up walls against foreign steel. Others, such as the radical environmentalists who want to save the rainforest, will simply lash out at globalization and all its manifestations without offering a sustainable economic alternative. Their only message will be, stop. As for the poorest human turtles in the developing world, those really left behind by globalization, they will express their backlash by simply eating the rainforest, each in their own way, without trying to explain it or justify it or wrap it in an ideological bow. In Indonesia, they will eat the Chinese merchants by ransacking their stores. In Russia, they will sell weapons to Iran or turn to crime. In Brazil, they will log the rest of the rainforest or join the peasant movement in the Brazilian countryside called Sem Teto, without roofs, who simply steal what they need. There are an estimated 3.5 million of them in Brazil, agricultural people without land, living in some 250 encampments around the country. Sometimes they live by the roads and just close the roads until they are paid or evicted. Sometimes they invade supermarkets, rob banks, or steal trucks. They have no flag, no manifesto. They have only their own unmet needs and aspirations. That's why what we have been seeing in many countries, instead of popular mass opposition to globalization, is wave after wave of crime, people just grabbing what they need, weaving their own social safety nets, and not worrying about the theory or ideology. But while this backlash may be a bit incoherent and only loosely connected, it is very real. It comes from the depth of people's souls and pocketbooks, and therefore, if it achieves a critical mass, can influence politics in any country. Societies ignore it at their own peril. In almost every country that has put on the golden straitjacket, you have at least one populist party or major candidate who is campaigning all the time now against globalization. They offer various protectionist, populist solutions that they claim will produce the same standards of living without having to either run so fast, trade so far, or open the borders so wide. They all claim that by just putting up a few new walls here and there, everything will be fine. They appeal to all the people who prefer their pasts to their future. In Russia, for instance, the communist members of the Duma continue to lead a backlash against globalization by telling the working classes and pensioners that in the days of the Soviet Union they may have had lousy jobs and been forced to wait in bread lines, but they always knew there would be a job and always knew there would be some bread they could afford at the head of the line. The strength of these populist anti-globalization candidates depends to a large degree on the weakness of the economy in the country that they are in. Usually, the weaker the economy, the wider the following these simplistic solutions will attract. But these anti-globalization populists don't only thrive in bad times. In 1998, the majority of the U.S. Congress refused to give the president authority to expand NAFTA to Chile, Little Chile, on the argument that this would lead to a loss of American jobs. This wrong-headed view carried the day at a time when the American stock market was at a record high, American unemployment was at a record low, and virtually every study showed that NAFTA had been a win-win-win arrangement for the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Think of how stupid this was. The U.S. Congress appropriated $18 billion to replenish the International Monetary Fund so that it could do more bailouts of countries struggling with globalization. But the Congress would not accept expansion of the NAFTA Free Trade Zone to Chile. What is the logic of that? It could only be, we support aid, not trade. It makes no sense. But the reason these arguments can resonate in good times as well as bad is that moments of rapid change like this breed enormous insecurity as well as enormous prosperity. They can breed in people a powerful sense that their lives are now controlled by forces they cannot see or touch. The globalization system is still too new for too many people, and involves too much change for too many people, for them to have confidence that even the good job they have will always be there. And this creates a lot of room for backlash demagogues with simplistic solutions. It also creates a powerful feeling in some people that we need to slow this world down, put back some walls or some sand in the gears. Not so I can get off, but so I can stay on. And don't kid yourself. The backlash is not just an outburst from the most downtrodden. Like all revolutions, globalization involves a shift in power from one group to another. In most countries, it involves a power shift from the state and its bureaucrats to the private sector and entrepreneurs. As this happens, all those who derive their status from positions in the bureaucracy or from their ties to it, or from their place in a highly regulated and protected economic system, can become losers if they can't make the transition to the fast world. This includes industrialists and cronies who were anointed with import or export monopolies by their government, business owners who were protected by the government through high import tariffs on the products they made, big labor unions who got used to each year winning fewer work hours with more pay in constantly protected markets, workers in state-owned factories who got paid whether the factory made a profit or not, the unemployed in welfare states who enjoyed relatively generous benefits and health care no matter what, and all those who depended on the largesse of the state to protect them from the global market and free them from its most demanding aspects. This explains why, in some countries, the strongest backlash against globalization comes not just from the poorest segments of the population and the turtles, but rather from the used-to-bes in the middle and lower middle classes, who found a great deal of security in the protected communist, socialist, and welfare systems. As they have seen the walls of protection around them coming down, as they have seen the rigged games in which they flourished folded up, and the safety nets under them shrink, many have become mighty unhappy. And unlike the turtles, these downwardly mobile groups have the political clout to organize against globalization. The AFL-CIO Labor Union Federation has become probably the most powerful political force against globalization in the United States. Labor unions covertly funded a lot of the advertising on behalf of the demonstrations in Seattle to encourage grassroots opposition to free trade. One of my first tastes of this middle-class backlash against globalization came by accident when I was in Beijing talking to Wang Jise, who heads the North America desk at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. We drifted from talking about America to talking about his own life in a China that was rapidly moving toward the free market, which many Chinese both welcome and fear. The market mechanism is coming to China, but the question is how to impose it, said Wang. I depend on my work unit for my housing. If all the housing goes to a free market system, I might lose my housing. I am not a conservative, but when it comes to practical issues like this, people can become conservatives if they are just thrown onto the market after being accustomed to being taken care of. My driver complained to me the other day that when he was younger he contributed all his energy and everything he had to Maoism and to socialist construction. But now he is 45 or 50, and suddenly he is asked to go into the market. Is it fair, he is asking of the government, that I devoted myself to whatever you asked of me for decades, and now suddenly you forget me? You push me into the market when I get older? It is not fair. I have done nothing wrong. I have always followed your instructions, dear government. But now your instructions are to forget about the government. This driver enjoys working here with us. He does not want to become a taxi driver and lose all his benefits. He does not want to go into the market. You don't have to be a communist worker bee to feel this way. Peter Schwartz, chairman of the Global Business Network, a consulting firm, once told me about a conversation he had before being interviewed in London for an economics program on the BBC. The British reporter for the show, while escorting me to the interview, was asking me about some of my core ideas. I alluded to the idea that Britain was a good example of the takeoff of the entrepreneurial economy, particularly compared to the rest of Europe, and that the best indicator of the difference was the difference in unemployment in the UK and continental Europe. At that point he said to me, "Isn't that terrible? Unemployment benefits are now so low in Britain, it isn't worth staying on the dole anymore, and people have to go to work." Schwartz then added, "There are people who see this transformation to globalization as a big loss, not a gain. They are losing not just a benefit, but something they perceived as a right, the notion that modern industrial societies are so wealthy that it is the right of people to receive generous unemployment insurance." If you want to see this war between the protected and the globalizers at its sharpest today, go to the Arab world. In 1996, Egypt was scheduled to host the Middle East Economic Summit, which was to bring together Western, Asian, Arab, and Israeli business executives. The Egyptian bureaucracy fought bitterly against holding the summit. In part, this was politically inspired by those in Egypt who did not feel Israel had done enough vis-a-vis the Palestinians to really merit normalization. But in part, it was because the Egyptian bureaucrats, who had dominated the Egyptian economy ever since Nasser nationalized all the big commercial institutions in the 1960s, intuitively understood that this summit could be the first step in their losing power to the private sector, which was already being given the chance to purchase various state-owned enterprises and could eventually get its hands on the state-controlled media. The Islamic opposition newspaper, Al-Shaab, denounced the economic summit as the Conference of Shame. For the first time, though, the Egyptian private sector got itself organized into power lobbies. The American Egypt Chamber of Commerce, the President's Council of Egyptian Business Leaders, and the Egypt Businessmen's Association, and tugged President Mubarak the other way, saying that hosting a summit with hundreds of investors from around the world was essential to produce jobs for an Egyptian workforce growing by 400,000 new entrants each year. President Mubarak went back and forth, finally siding with the private sector and agreeing to host the summit, and bluntly declaring in his opening speech, "This year, Egypt joined the global economy. It will live by its rules." But the Egyptian bureaucracy, which does not want to cede any power to the private sector, is still fighting that move. And every time there is a downturn in the global economy, such as the Asian collapse in 1998, the Egyptian bureaucrats go to Mubarak and say, "See, we told you so. We need to slow down, put up some new walls. Otherwise, what happened to Brazil will happen to us." For a long time, I thought that this Egyptian reluctance to really plug into the globalization system was rooted simply in the ignorance of bureaucrats and a total lack of vision from the top. But then I had an eye-opening experience. I did an author's tour of Egypt in early 2000, meeting with students at Cairo University, journalists at Egyptian newspapers, and business leaders in Cairo and Alexandria to talk about the Arabic edition of this book. Two images stood out from this trip. The first was riding the train from Cairo to Alexandria in a car full of middle and upper class Egyptians. So many of them had cell phones that kept ringing with different piercing melodies during the 2-hour trip that at one point I felt like getting up, taking out a baton, and conducting a cell phone symphony. I was so rattled from ringing phones I couldn't wait to get off the train. Yet while all these phones were chirping inside the train, outside we were passing along the Nile, where barefoot Egyptian villagers were tilling their fields with the same tools and water buffalo that their ancestors used in Pharaoh's day. I couldn't imagine a wider technology gap within one country. Inside the train, it was AD 2000. Outside, it was 2000 BC. The other image was visiting Youssef Boutros Ghali, Egypt's MIT-trained minister of economy. When I arrived at his building, the elevator operator, an Egyptian peasant, was waiting for me at the elevator, which he operated with a key. Before he turned it on, though, to take me up to the minister's office, he whispered the Quranic verse, "In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate." To a Westerner, it is unnerving to hear your elevator operator utter a prayer before he closes the door. But for him, this was a cultural habit, rooted deep in his tradition. Again, the contrast. Mr. Boutros Ghali is the most creative, high-tech driver of globalization in Egypt. But his elevator man says a prayer before taking you up to his office. These scenes captured for me the real tension at the heart of Egypt. While its small, cell phone-armed, globalizing elites were definitely pushing to get online and onto the global economic train, most others feared they would be left behind or lose their identity trying to catch it. Indeed, I was struck, after a week of discussing both the costs and benefits of globalization, how most Egyptians, including many intellectuals, could see only the costs. The more I explained globalization, the more they expressed unease about it. It eventually struck me that I was encountering what anthropologists call systematic misunderstanding. Systematic misunderstanding arises when your framework and the other person's framework are so fundamentally different that it cannot be corrected by providing more information. The Egyptians' unease about globalization is rooted partly in a justifiable fear that they still lack the technological base to compete. But it's also rooted in something cultural. And not just the professor at Cairo University asked me, "Does globalization mean we all have to become Americans?" The unease goes deeper, and you wouldn't understand the backlash against globalization in traditional societies unless you understand it. Many Americans can easily identify with modernization, technology, and the Internet, because one of the most important things these do is increase individual choices. At their best, they empower and emancipate the individual. But for traditional societies such as Egypt's, the collective, the group, is much more important than the individual, and empowering the individual is equated with dividing the society. So globalizing for them not only means being forced to eat more Big Macs, it means changing the relationship of the individual to his state and community in a way that they feel is socially disintegrating. Does globalization mean we just leave the poor to fend for themselves? One educated Egyptian woman asked me. How do we privatize when we have no safety nets? Asked a professor. When the government here says it is privatizing an industry, the instinctive reaction of Egyptians is that something is being stolen from the state, said a senior Egyptian official. After enough such conversations, I realized that most Egyptians, understandably, were approaching globalization out of a combination of despair and necessity, not out of any sense of opportunity. Globalization meant adapting to a threat coming from the outside, not increasing their own freedoms. I also realized that their previous ideologies, Arab nationalism, socialism, fascism, or communism, while they may have made no economic sense, had a certain inspirational power. But globalism totally lacks this. When you tell a traditional society it has to streamline, downsize, and get with the Internet, it is a challenge that is devoid of any redemptive or inspirational force. And that is why, for all of globalization's obvious power to elevate living standards, it is going to be a tough, tough sell to all those millions who still say a prayer before they ride the elevator. This tug of war is now going on all over the Arab world today, from Morocco to Kuwait. As one senior Arab finance official described this globalization struggle in his country, "Sometimes I feel like I am part of the Freemasons or some secret society because I am looking at the world so differently from many of the people around me. There is a huge chasm between the language and vocabulary I have and them. It is not that I have failed to convince them. I often can't even communicate with them. They are so far away from this global outlook. So for me, when I am pushing a policy issue related to globalization, the question always becomes, how many people can I rally to this concept, and can I create a critical mass to effect a transition? If you can get enough of your people in the right places, you can push the system along. But it's hard. On so many days, I feel like I have people coming to me and saying, we really need to repaint the room, and I am saying, no, we really need to rebuild the whole building on a new foundation. So their whole dialogue with you is about what color paint to use, and all you can see in your head is the whole new architecture that needs to be done and the new foundations that need to be laid. We can worry about the color of paint later. Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, they now have that critical mass of people and officials who can see this world. But most developing countries are not there yet, which is why their transition is still so uncertain. In Morocco, the government is privatizing simply by selling many state-owned enterprises to the same small economic clique tied to the royal palace that once dominated the state monopolies. This is why 3% of Morocco's population controls 85% of the country's wealth. Morocco's universities, which uniquely combine the worst of the socialist and French education systems, each year turn out so many graduates who cannot find jobs and have no entrepreneurial or technical skills suited for today's information economy, that Morocco now has a union of unemployed university graduates. As more countries have plugged into the globalization system and the fast world, still another new backlash group has started to form, the Wounded Gazelles. This group comprises people who feel they have tried globalization, who have gotten hammered by the system, and who, instead of getting up, dusting themselves off, and doing whatever it takes to get back into the fast world, are now trying artificially to shut it out or get the rules of the whole system changed. The poster boy for this group is Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir. Hell hath no wrath like a globalizer burned. On October 25, 1997, in the midst of the Asian economic meltdown, Mahathir told the Edinburgh Commonwealth Summit that the global economy, which had poured billions of dollars of investments into Malaysia without which its spectacular growth would never have been possible, had become anarchic. "This is an unfair world," Mahathir fumed. "Many of us have struggled hard and even shed blood in order to be independent. When borders are down and the world becomes a single entity, independence can become meaningless." Not surprisingly, in 1998, Mahathir was the first Asian globalizer to impose capital controls in an effort to halt the wild speculative swings in his own currency and stock market. When Singapore's Minister for Information, George Yeo, described Mahathir's move at the time, he said, "Malaysia has retreated to a lagoon and is trying to anchor its boats, but the strategy is not without risk." Indeed, it is not. If you think you can retreat permanently into an artificially constructed third space and enjoy all the rising living standards of the fast world without any of the pressures, you are really fooling yourself and your people. Nevertheless, Mahathir's retreat, which proved to be only temporary, was received with a certain amount of sympathy in the developing world, although it was not copied by anyone. As we enter the second decade of globalization, there is an increasing awareness among those countries that have resisted the golden straitjacket and the fast world that they cannot go on resisting. And they know that a strategy of retreat will not produce growth over the long run. For several years, I would meet Imad El-Din Adib, editor of the Egyptian journal Al Alam Al Yom, at different World Bank meetings and other settings, and for several years he would express to me strong reservations about Egypt joining this globalization system. When I saw him in 1999 at the Davos Forum, he said to me, "Okay, I understand we need to get prepared for this globalization, and that is partly our responsibility. There is a train that is leaving, and we should have known this and done our homework. But now, you should slow the train down a bit and give us a chance to jump on." I didn't have the heart to tell him that I had just come from a press lunch with Bill Gates. All the reporters there kept asking him, "Mr. Gates, these internet stocks, they're a bubble, right? Surely they're a bubble. They must be a bubble." Finally, an exasperated Gates said to the reporters, "Look, of course they're a bubble, but you're all missing the point. This bubble is going to attract so much new capital to this internet industry that it is going to drive innovation faster and faster." So there I was, in the morning, listening to Bill Gates telling me that the fast world was about to get even faster, and in the afternoon, listening to Adib tell me that he wanted to hop on, but could someone just slow it down a bit? "I wish we could slow this globalization train down," I told Adib, "but there's no one at the controls." I was once having coffee at the Internet Cafe in Amman, Jordan, which is called Books at Cafe, and is just down the street from the incredibly well-preserved ruins of one of the great Roman amphitheaters in the Middle East. I visited there in September 1997, and the owner, Madian Al-Jazeera, stopped by my table to introduce himself. He insisted that I have a piece of banana cream pie on the house. "Why banana cream pie?" I asked. Well, he explained, it was made by the wife of the Israeli deputy ambassador in Amman. "Let me get this straight," I said. "The banana cream pie at the Internet Cafe in Amman is made by the wife of the Israeli deputy ambassador?" "That's great. I love it." Well, it wasn't so great for everyone, he explained. When the Islamic fundamentalists in Amman found out that the banana cream pie at the Internet Cafe in Amman was made by the wife of an Israeli diplomat, they called for a boycott of the Internet Cafe until it removed the pie from the menu. "And they called for the boycott on the local Internet," the owner said. Obviously, the boycott failed, and the pie is still on the menu. The anti-Israeli-made banana cream pie fundamentalists represent still another backlash against globalization. It is the backlash of all those millions of people who detest the way globalization homogenizes people, puts Israeli-made banana cream pie in the face of a Jordanian Muslim, brings strangers into your home with strange ways, erases the distinctiveness of cultures, and mercilessly uproots the olive trees that locate and anchor you in the world. Many people, obviously, are ready either to abandon a lot of their local culture in favor of an Americanized, globalized consumer culture, or to juggle the two together in their lives, clothes, eating habits, and outlook. And people's capacity for juggling these sorts of things should never be underestimated. If people weren't such good jugglers, McDonald's and Disney would not enjoy such worldwide popularity. But some people are not into juggling. In fact, they are ready to go to war to protect their local culture from the global. Their war cry is, "I don't want to be global, I want to be local." For globalizers, hierarchy is about those who are most connected. For fundamentalists, hierarchy is about those who are most disconnected from anything but their one source of truth. Where this cultural backlash becomes the most politically destabilizing is when it gets married to one of the other backlashes, when groups that are economically aggrieved by globalization merge with those who are culturally aggrieved. This phenomenon is most apparent in the Middle East, where fundamentalists of many stripes have become highly adept at weaving the cultural, political, and economic backlashes against globalization into one flag and one broad political movement that seeks to take power and pull down a veil against the world. The first flag of the Algerian opposition was an empty sack used to hold couscous, the popular North African grain, which symbolized the frustration of Algerian workers, and particularly young people, at not having any work. Slowly, though, those carrying that empty couscous sack made common cause with Islamic fundamentalists, opposed to the westernizing, secularizing ways of the Algerian regime. And together they produced a powerful backlash under the green Islamic fundamentalist flag against those in Algeria who wanted to link the country to the globalization system. Benjamin Netanyahu's election to Prime Minister of Israel in 1996 was partly a political backlash against the problems of the Oslo Peace Accords. But it was also a cultural backlash against the globalization and integration implicit in Israel's peacemaking with the Arabs. Israeli religious scholar Moshe Halbertal once remarked to me that Shimon Peres's vision that his grandchildren and Yasser Arafat's grandchildren would all make microchips together was something fundamentally threatening to many religious Jews in Israel. They feared that if the ghetto walls fell around Israel and Israel assimilated into the Middle East, the same way American Jews assimilated into America, it would not be good for Judaism. They worried, at some level, that peace now and Jewish now could not really coexist, particularly when peace seemed to mean more globalization, more integration, more blockbuster video, more smut-ridden cable stations and pizza huts. Hence the signs that appeared in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods on the eve of Netanyahu's 1996 election, "Vote for Bibi. He's good for the Jews." In Israel, too, though, the cultural backlash against globalization has merged with the economic and political one. In the wake of the peace agreement with Jordan, Israeli textile manufacturers began doing the logical thing, which was moving their low-skilled textile jobs from Israeli development towns, such as Kiryat Gat, across the river to Jordan, where wages are a fraction of what they are in Israel. Suddenly, Israeli textile workers, who are not ready for the Intel factory that is also being built in Israel, find their jobs going to Jordan, a place where their jobs could never have moved without peace and globalization. The workers in Kiryat Gat worry that peace now and jobs now won't go together. And since many of them are Oriental Jews, they react by throwing their political support to Shas, the ultra-Orthodox Sephardi party, which is opposed to globalization on religious cultural grounds and is mostly interested in Messiah now. So Messiah now, Jewish now, and jobs now all get merged together into one protest movement that is hostile to globalization. To be sure, there is nothing wrong with trying to anchor your society on a foundation of religious and traditional values. These are important olive trees that anchor a society. Not everyone advocating such values is somehow engaged in violent fundamentalism. But when this fundamentalism is driven not by real spirituality, but by a backlash against globalization, it often lapses into sectarianism, violence, and exclusivity. And the more non-inclusive you become, the less networked you are, the more you will fall behind, and the more you fall behind, the more you will want to retreat and reject the outside world with more exclusivity. But you don't have to be a Muslim or Jewish fundamentalist to want to join the backlash against globalization, because of how it can make you feel like a stranger in your own backyard. This is a universal phenomenon. I was touring Asia when the Australians held their 1996 national election, and was struck by how much of their campaign revolved around biscuits and bathing suits. Yes, the issue in Australia was this. John Howard, who was then head of Australia's Conservative Party, claimed that Paul Keating's ruling Labour Party, in its zeal to have Australia integrate with the global economy and become more open to foreign investment, had created a situation in which Australia's most cherished companies were being bought up by global corporations based abroad and owned by foreigners. Howard charged that Australians were losing their national icons, indeed their very sovereignty and identity, to the global marketplace, even though they were improving their economy. In particular, he pointed to the fact that Arnott's biscuits, which every Australian schoolchild grew up with, had been sold to a U.S. company, Campbell's Soup, no less, which would probably start tampering with its recipe for iced Vovos, Australia's most famous cookie, made of marshmallows and coconut. The same was true, Howard said, of Australia's famous Speedo bathing suits, which he complained had been sold to a U.S. firm. What happened to iced Vovos and Speedo bathing suits actually became a hot topic of one of the election debates, and these olive tree-hugging arguments helped Howard defeat the Lexus-loving Keating in a landslide. A year later, I was riding through the farmland of Indiana in the spring of 1997 on my way to Purdue University, being driven by a very thoughtful Purdue history professor, John Larson. As we got near Lafayette, I saw a huge factory looming on the horizon. "What is that?" I asked. It's the Subaru factory, Professor Larson explained as we got closer. Then he added that this Subaru factory was Indiana's first experience as a third world country. How so? I asked. For the generation like mine that grew up in the 1950s, it was America that was doing all the outreaching, said Larson. We did all the globalizing. But when the Japanese car people were looking for a site for the Subaru factory, they came in here the way Americans go into India, asking all these questions. Can we have what we want? Do we trust you people? Do you have a stable workforce? What is the education level here? Will we get tax breaks? The community leaders here were eager for the investment, but some people asked, who are these Japanese to ask about our schools? Once the Subaru people decided to put their factory in Lafayette, someone suggested that they rename the highway that ran in front of the factory, something like Subaru Highway, in honor of this company that was coming in and bringing all these jobs. But then the local VFW heard about it, and they raised a huge fuss, explained Larson. They said, you can't rename that highway. Don't you know what its name stands for? The highway was already called Bataan Highway, named in honor of the peninsula in the Philippines where thousands of Americans died on a death march after being captured by the Japanese in April 1942. The Subaru people were very sensitive and said that by all means we shouldn't rename the Bataan Highway Subaru Highway, said Professor Larson. Since then, people have gotten quite used to the Japanese, and they have been well accepted. Japanese managers rotate in and out of here with their families. Their kids go to the local schools, except on Saturday when the Japanese kids also go to their own schools to keep up with their language, and because they don't think our math training is rigorous enough. Chapter 16. The Groundswell, or the Backlash Against the Backlash. In the winter of 1995, I visited Hanoi. Every morning to get my exercise, I would walk around the pagodas on Hoan Kiem Lake in the heart of Hanoi, and every morning I would stop to visit a tiny Vietnamese woman crouched on the sidewalk with her bathroom scale. She was offering to weigh people for a small fee, and every morning I would pay her a dollar and weigh myself. It wasn't that I needed to know how much I weighed. I knew how much I weighed, and my recollection is that her scale was not particularly accurate. No, doing business with that lady was my contribution to the globalization of Vietnam. To me, her unspoken motto was, whatever you've got, no matter how big or small, sell it, trade it, barter it, leverage it, rent it, but do something with it to turn a profit, improve your standard of living, and get into the game. That lady and her scale embody a fundamental truth about globalization, which too often gets lost in talk of elite money managers, hedge funds, and high-speed microprocessors. And it is this. Globalization emerges from below, from street level, from people's very souls and from their very deepest aspirations. Yes, globalization is the product of the democratizations of finance, technology, and information. But what is driving all three of these is the basic human desire for a better life, a life with more freedom to choose how to prosper, what to eat, what to wear, where to live, where to travel, how to work, what to read, what to write, and what to learn. It starts with a lady in Hanoi, crouched on the sidewalk, offering up a bathroom scale as her ticket to the fast world. In central Hanoi today, every inch of sidewalk seems to be covered by someone selling something off a mat, out of a trunk, or from the shelves of a storefront. Every inch of road is occupied by people who have traded their sandals for a bicycle, their bicycle for a motor scooter, their motor scooter for a Honda Civic, their Honda Civic for a Toyota Camry, and yes, even their Toyota Camry for the occasional Lexus. Because we tend to think of globalization as something that countries connect to outside themselves, or something imposed from above and beyond, we tend to forget how much, at its heart, it is also a grassroots movement that emerges from within each of us. This explains why, along with the backlash against the brutalities, pressures, and challenges of globalization, there is a groundswell of people demanding the benefits of globalization. This groundswell is propelled by millions of workers who have been knocked around by globalization, but who nonetheless get up, dust themselves off, and knock again on globalization's door, demanding to get into the system. Because if they have half a chance, the turtles don't want to be turtles, the left-behinds don't want to remain behind, and the no-nots want to know something more. They want to be lions or gazelles. They want to get a piece of the system, not to destroy it. I happened to be in Rio de Janeiro when the Brazilian government privatized the state telephone company Telebrás. There was a big street protest in Rio against the privatization. What struck me most, though, was that the next day the Brazilian newspaper O Globo carried an interview with one of the demonstrators, asking him why he had come. He answered that he came to the demonstration because, "I thought I might get a job." The poor guy wasn't against privatization. He just wanted a share. People will accept a lot more stress associated with globalization than one might think, in part because Russian miners, Mexican peasants, and Indonesian laborers understand at some level that they don't really have any choice but to get up to speed for the fast world, and in part because many of them don't want it any other way. Obviously, if market forces get totally out of whack, if people feel that the system has become so crazy that the connection between hard work and a better standard of living gets severed, and therefore no amount of painful reforms or belt tightening will get them a share, then this system is in danger. But we have not reached that point. Yet. Think about the Russian workers, who after the fall of communism were not paid for weeks or months. Why didn't they burn down the Kremlin? Because they've been to that play before, and they know how it ends. They want a different ending this time: prosperity, freedom, choices, and they are ready to make incredible sacrifices for it. My favorite story out of Russia in 1998 was told to a friend of mine by a Russian economist about a Russian tank driver in a town behind the Urals, who drove his tank to City Hall and demanded all his long overdue paychecks. When the frightened townsfolk surrounded the tank and asked the driver if he intended to blow up City Hall, he said, "No, no, no. The only reason he drove his tank was because he didn't have any other way to get there and couldn't afford a taxi. He just wanted to get paid." Indeed, for all the churning that global capitalism brings to a society, the spread of capitalism has raised living standards higher, faster, and for more people than at any time in history. It has also brought more poor people into the middle classes more quickly than at any time in human history. So while the gap between rich and poor is getting wider, as the winners in today's globalization system really take off and separate themselves from everyone else, the floor under the poor has been rising steadily in many parts of the world. In other words, while relative poverty may be growing in many countries, absolute poverty is actually falling in many countries. According to the 1997 United Nations Human Development Report, poverty has fallen more in the past 50 years than in the previous 500. Developing countries have progressed as fast in the past 30 years as the industrialized world did in the previous century. Since 1960, infant mortality rates, malnutrition, and illiteracy are all significantly down, while access to safe water is way up. In relatively short periods of time, countries that have been the most open to globalization, like Taiwan, Singapore, Israel, Chile, and Sweden, have achieved standards of living comparable to those in America and Japan. while the ranks of the middle class in countries like Thailand, Brazil, India, and Korea have swelled, due partly to globalization. Consider the following article from The Economist, January 8, 2000. Beware. Multinational companies are on the rampage, destroying jobs, stamping on wages, and generally wrecking local economies. Or so the critics of globalization make out. But a cool look at the numbers tells a different story, as is clear from a new cross-country study by the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the first to take a detailed look at the contribution of foreign firms to national economies. Fact 1. Foreign firms pay their workers more than the national average, and the gap is widening. In America, for example, foreign firms paid 4% more than domestic ones in 1989. In 1996, they paid 6% more. Fact 2. In most countries, foreign firms are creating jobs faster than are their domestic counterparts. In America, the workforce of foreign firms rose by 1.4% a year between 1989 and 1996, compared with an annual rise of 0.8% at domestic ones. In both Britain and France, employment at foreign firms increased by 1.7% a year. At domestic ones, it fell by 2.7%. Only in Germany and the Netherlands did foreign firms shed workers. Fact 3. Foreign firms spend heavily on research and development, R&D, in the countries where they invest. In 1996, they accounted for 12% of America's R&D spending, 19% of France's, and a remarkable 40% of Britain's. Indeed, in some countries, foreign firms spend more of their turnover on R&D than domestic ones. In Britain, for example, foreign firms spend 2% of their turnover on R&D, domestic firms only 1.5%. Fact 4. Foreign firms tend to export more than domestic ones. In 1996, foreign firms in Ireland exported 89% of their output. Domestic ones, only 34%. The gap was 64% to 37% in the Netherlands, 35.2% to 33.6% in France, and 13.1% to 10.6% in Japan. The big exception is America, where domestic firms exported 15.3% of their output, foreign ones only 10.7%. These benefits of foreign investment are even bigger in the OECD's poorer economies. Take Turkey. Foreign firms' wages are 124% above average. Their workforce has risen by 11.5% a year compared with 0.6% in domestic ones, and their R&D spending is twice as high as in domestic firms. No wonder, then, that while the backlash against globalization is alive and well, this backlash is constantly being tempered by the groundswell for more globalization, more people wanting into the system. You don't need to be a political scientist to figure that out. All you have to do is walk down the street in practically any developing country. You'll meet Chinookfat Fitikwanakun, a 40-year-old Thai Chinese woman who sells cigarettes and Bao Chinese dumplings from her little stand on Wireless Road in the heart of downtown Bangkok. I was staying at a hotel near there in December 1997, the week the government closed most of the country's finance houses, and I asked the New York Times interpreter to accompany me on a walk to get some reactions from the street merchants. The first person I chatted with was Chinookfat. I began by asking her, "How's business?" "Off by 40 or 50%," she said sullenly. I asked her if she had ever heard of George Soros, the billionaire hedge fund manager who was then being blamed for speculating on the Asian currencies and triggering their collapse. "No," she said, shaking her head. She had never heard of Soros. Well, let me ask you this. Do you know what a stock market is? I asked. Yes, she answered, without hesitation. I own shares in Bangkok Bank and Asia Bank. How in the world did you think of buying bank shares? I asked. My relatives were all buying, so I bought two, she answered. I put them away in the bank. They are not worth much now. At that point, I looked down and noticed that she wasn't wearing any shoes. Maybe she had shoes somewhere, but they weren't on her feet. I couldn't help thinking to myself, she has no shoes, she has a fifth-grade education, but she owns bank stocks on the Thai Stock Exchange. Some questions then occurred to me. What are her interests? Is she going to lead a march to burn down the IMF office that is imposing all these conditions on Thailand to reform its economy? Or because she is now somehow part of the system, would she be prepared to work harder, save more, and sacrifice more, even to the IMF, if it would help revive the Thai economy? Something tells me it's the latter. That's the groundswell at work. You'll meet Thira Futrakul, who heads one of the biggest mutual funds in Thailand. I went to interview him one afternoon in Bangkok about whether there would be a backlash in Thailand against Western and American bankers who might try to move in and buy up Thai banks and businesses now that their currency was so cheap and many firms were flat on their backs. Thira thought for a moment and then answered by telling me a story. A few weeks ago, a friend of his had had his wallet stolen. In his wallet, he had credit cards from four banks, American Express and three Thai banks. Right away, he called American Express and the three Thai banks and reported his missing credit cards. American Express asked him if he wanted a new card sent over by motor scooter the same day. He still has not heard from the three Thai banks. So, said Thira, ask yourself this. Will my friend really care if those three Thai banks are now bought up by Citibank and have their standards brought up to the same level as American Express? Will he feel a sense of